Israelite to Jew with Michael Sadlow. Episode 5, Ezra. Who would have thought that the greatest, richest catch of Jewish art from antiquity would be found in a dusty Syrian town? Yet at the beginning of the 20th century, that is precisely what happened. The town of Dura Europis was in the borderlands, at the far reaches of the Roman Empire in late antiquity. Just over the border, in the 3rd century of the Common Era, was a re-emergent Persia under the leadership of Shapur. Shapur's forces attacked in 256 CE. The Roman garrison never had much of a chance, but they did try to hold out. As the Persians approached, they attempted to buttress the town's walls by filling with sand the rooms and buildings that were directly against the interior of the walls. One of these rooms was the town synagogue. The sand ultimately was ineffectual against the Persians, but it did a great job preserving frescoes that lavishly covered the walls of the synagogue. The synagogue was only partially preserved, but it seems like every inch of wall space was decorated. These paintings, done as separate panels, depicted scenes from the Bible. Despite many ingenious attempts to explain the selection of scenes and their placement, no theory has yet to attract a scholarly consensus. The painters, or those who commissioned them, seemed partial to the stories of King David and to Esther, although other panels depict the Israelite crossing at the Sea of Reeds, Ezekiel's vision of the dry bones being raised by the hand of God, and Moses standing alone at the burning bush. The panel depicting Moses resembles another panel of a solitary man. About 30 and sporting a closely trimmed beard, this man wears a fashionable toga and solid sandals. He looks out at us, an open scroll in his hands. His name is Ezra. In the last episode, I discussed the first two waves of return to Jerusalem, each by some of the descendants of the Israelite exiles in Babylonia, now under Persian rule. Sheshbazar, you might remember, led the first return in 539 BCE. Zerubbabel and Joshua came 17 years later and completed rebuilding the Second Temple in 516 BCE. In this episode, I turn to the career of Ezra about 60 years later and his own mission to Jerusalem. As portrayed in the Bible and remembered in legend and lore, as the painting in Dura Europis attests, Ezra was a complex and remarkable man. Before resuming our story, though, I must provide a technical caveat. How we understand Ezra and the significance of his actions depends greatly on how we date him. When did he live? Perhaps more important than establishing an absolute date for him is dating him relative to Nehemiah. Did Ezra come to Jerusalem and then leave it or die prior to Nehemiah? Did his mission overlap with that of Nehemiah? Or did Nehemiah come first? Our sources are maddeningly vague on this point, and all three of these scenarios can legitimately be argued. The main problem is that the book of Ezra dates Ezra's mission to the 7th year of the reign of the king Artaxerxes. Now we have a good precise date. We know the regnal years of the kings of Persia. But which Artaxerxes was meant? If it was Artaxerxes I, then his 7th year would have been 458 BCE. If Artaxerxes II, we're talking about 398 BCE. Nehemiah's dating is less controversial and generally set to 445 BCE. So there really is something at stake in figuring out which Artaxerxes was meant. There is an additional complication. As currently preserved, the Hebrew Bible puts a scene that involves Ezra smack in the middle of the book of Nehemiah, strongly suggesting that their missions overlapped. Yet the parallel version of the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, as preserved in the Greek translation, the Septuagint, and known as 1st and 2nd Esdras, puts this chapter back with the story of Ezra. We don't know if the Hebrew version, as currently preserved, is original. It is possible that the Greek translator was working from an earlier and more accurate version of the Hebrew text. I've already gone a bit deeper into this problem, perhaps, than necessary, and I will skip over the many other problems, evidence, and technical arguments for dating. Suffice it to say that I am partial to the arguments for dating Ezra prior to Nehemiah. So, for the purposes of this podcast episode, that is where we will put him. But I didn't want you to think that I was pulling a fast one on you. Ezra was a priest, but not just any priest. He was part of one of the more distinguished priestly families. It was his genealogical status as a priest that would have given him most of his religious authority. Remember that priesthood in Israel was what anthropologists call an ascribed status. You don't do anything to get it. It is simply a matter of birth. Ezra had the right genes. But he also had more. Immediately after informing us of his priestly status, the author of the book of Ezra goes on to note that Ezra was a scribe expert in the teaching of Moses which the Lord God of Israel had given. While one might be born into a family of scribes, being a scribe and an expert was not an ascribed status. It was achieved status, attained as the result of merit, at least in theory. Remember that scribes were present in pre-exilic Israel, but their authority and status was quite limited, and decidedly inferior to that of priests and prophets. With Ezra, we begin to see the growth of scribal power, of expertise in a book, in fact, in the specific book of the teaching of Moses, as an effective claim of religious authority. Ezra could draw then both on his ascribed and his achieved positions as he made claims to religious authority. We should assume that he was not the only one of his generation to possess this combination. But it seems that he also had something that would have been even more important when it came to his emergence as a communal leader, access to the king of Persia. We do not know how Ezra got this access, but from it, he obtains a position of authority from King Artaxerxes. Like Sheshbazzar and Zerubbabel before him, the Persian king gives him his power. The letter of commission that Artaxerxes sent to Ezra, preserved in Aramaic in the book of Ezra, chapter 7, may or may not be authentic, and even if authentic, was most likely embellished by a pious Judean scribe. Nevertheless, the basic content I take to be more or less accurate, and in any case, much of it is familiar from the previous edicts of the kings of Persia. Any Israelite who wishes to go back with Ezra to Jerusalem may. The Persian treasury will provide gifts and vessels for the temple. The needs of the returnees on the road are to be provided for. And those involved directly in the service of the temple, for example, priests, Levites, temple servants, are to receive a tax exemption. The added twist in this document, though, is that Ezra is, and here I quote from chapter 7, verse 14, to regulate Judah and Jerusalem according to the law of your God. The document returns to this directive at the end, stating in verses 25 to 26, and you, Ezra, by the divine wisdom you possess, appoint magistrates and judges to judge all the people in the province of beyond the river who know the laws of your God, and to teach those who do not know them. Let anyone who does not obey the law of your God and the law of the king be punished with dispatch, whether by death, corporal punishment, confiscation of possessions, or imprisonment. Ezra thus draws for his authority not only on the goodwill of the people and their belief that he is fit to lead them, but on the carrots and sticks of the Persian kingdom. His ability to marshal material support and tax breaks must have been appreciated. But just in case they weren't, it did not hurt that he would have had access to the coercive organs of the state. So this third wave of returnees set out with Ezra on the first day of the first month. This would have been Nisan, or the spring, of 458 BCE. Ezra brings with him genealogically fit priests and Levites. His concern for genealogical purity is not incidental. It is, as I mentioned in the last episode, and will return to momentarily, an essential part of his vision and ideology. Sometime between the 1st and 12th of Nisan, probably a few days out on their way to Jerusalem, Ezra stopped at a river and declared a fast. The purpose of the fast was to beseech God for a safe trip. But given the secular authority bestowed on Ezra by the king, why should Ezra be afraid? He soon tells us, "I was ashamed to ask the king for soldiers and horsemen to protect us against any enemy on the way, since we had told the king, 'The benevolent care of our God is for all who seek him, while his fierce anger is against all who forsake him.'" Ezra, it seems, had talked himself into a corner. He used God's benevolence and care for his people as an argument to get the proclamation from Artaxerxes. But once he did so, he thought that asking the king for protective troops would undermine his argument. Now, though, Ezra was concerned. He realized the potential danger in which he put the exiles as they started their 4 or 5 month trek. In addition to fasting and praying, Ezra divided the treasure that they were carrying among different camps, presumably to assure that were they to be attacked, they would not lose everything in one fell swoop. Fortunately for Ezra, the trip was uneventful. The party arrived in Jerusalem on the first day of the 5th month, the month of Av. They stayed for 3 days before bringing their precious cargo to the temple. The current priests and Levites accepted the gifts and the many sacrifices brought by the returnees. Having sacrificed, Ezra and the leaders of the returnees presented the royal orders to the ruling governors, and they were duly recognized. It is worth pausing for a minute to remember that this was the temple that was built in 516 BCE, 58 years earlier. We would now be 2 or 3 generations from Zerubbabel and Joshua. Their settlement apparently took, and the temple seems to be functioning. These new returnees under Ezra, though, had no intention of quietly taking their place. Like Zerubbabel and Joshua before them, Ezra and his group did not like what they saw. What they saw was intermarriage. The descendants of those who earlier returned had married those who had been previously there, who were themselves apparently the descendants of the native Israelites whom the Babylonians had not exiled in 586. Let me repeat that. This intermarriage was one made between Israelites, one group of which was pure and had returned from Babylonia, and the other of which judged to be impure, although were native there. The author of the book of Ezra knew full well that the condemnation of these unions looked strange. The biblical text hence attempts to finesse the issue. The charge is that the people of Israel, especially their leaders, had, and here I read from the book of Ezra, chapter 9, verse 1, "not separated themselves from the people of the land, whose abhorrent practices are like those of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Egyptians, and the Amorites." This is very clever wording. The author is not claiming that the peoples of the land were in fact descended from any of these peoples. They are instead accused of committing abhorrent practices like those of these earlier tribes. If this attempts to slide one by, so does the enumeration of the tribes themselves. These are the very tribes, and only these tribes, with whom Deuteronomy chapters 7 and 20 prohibits intermarriage. There is no general prohibition against intermarriage in the Bible until now, and Ezra seems to know that he is extending this earlier targeted ban more broadly. Why would intermarriage bother Ezra so much? For the pre-exilic authors, the problem with intermarriage was the potential for being led astray to worship one's spouse's gods. 1 Kings chapter 11 explicitly singles out Solomon for punishment, not because he intermarried per se, but because through intermarriage he was led to support his wives' cults. The problem in these pre-exilic texts is what intermarriage leads to, not intermarriage itself. Ezra, though, has a different and novel rationale for condemning intermarriage. As chapter 9, verse 2 continues, They have taken their daughters as wives for themselves and for their sons, so that the holy seed has become intermingled with the peoples of the land. The author's arguments are not couched in the language of potential ramifications, but in the language of purity. We are so used to other arguments against intermarriage that we might miss the gap between our thinking and Ezra's. Since the period of the emancipation of the Jews in Europe in the 19th century, the massive immigration of Eastern European Jews to America in the 19th and 20th centuries, and especially since the Holocaust, Jews have framed their argument against intermarriage in terms of survival of the people. This is perfectly understandable. The Jewish community was and remains fearful that Jews would marry non-Jews, that their children would not be raised as Jews, and that ultimately Jews in America and across the world would simply disappear. The fight against intermarriage is often framed as the fight for the very survival of the Jewish people. This, though, is a modern argument. It is not the Bible's, and it certainly is not Ezra's. Deuteronomy and 1 Kings do not care about the survival of the people per se. The issue there is proper worship of God. Ezra's concern is far more peculiar. It is, to be blunt, about semen. Ezra is worried that genealogically pure semen would end up in the wombs of the impure daughters of the land. I do not think that holy seed is here meant in any way metaphorically. It is to be taken quite literally. This is why, although the problem of giving Israelite daughters to impure men is mentioned in Ezra, it is only briefly and in passing. The real problem is with the impure women. Moreover, remember who possessed the holy seed. It is not all Israelite descendants, but the pure returnees. Among the Israelites, such concerns for genealogical purity was typically limited to the priests, or maybe even the Levites. Now, though, Ezra is extending this ban to all of Israel. It is as if Ezra was taking the notion that Israel is a people holy to God to its logical conclusion, treating the entire people as if they were all priests. If this interpretation is correct, it helps us to better understand not only what Ezra was up to, but also Zerubbabel and Joshua before him, and Nehemiah after him, all shared an ideology developed in Babylonia. This was not an ideology of or for the common Israelite. These were people who saw themselves as the vanguard, or in their own language, as a remnant, the small, genealogically pure, true worshipers of the God of Israel. To be a member of true Israel, it was no longer sufficient to simply be an Israelite, born of one or two Israelite parents. One needed to be the children of proper, pure Israelites. This was a sectarian, or at least a proto-sectarian ideology. The challenge for pro-sectarian ideologies and their bearers and leaders is applying them to real life. Ezra had choices. He could, after all, have used the coercive powers of the state to dissolve these marriages. He chose not to, probably because he knew how delicate his own justifications were. He would not have imperial support for long if he ruffled too many established feathers. Instead, he chose to make a public display of piety. The event apparently took place in the 9th month, now 4 months after Ezra's return. "When I heard this," Ezra says, "I rent my garments and robe. I tore hair out of my head and beard, and I sat desolate." In full public view, he made a confession on behalf of the people and prayed for forgiveness. Praying, making confession, weeping, and prostrating himself, he must have been quite a sight, and soon a crowd gathered around him. The situation was volatile. A certain Shechaniah stepped forward out of this mob to confess and to urge others to make a covenant with him, to expel the foreign women and their offspring. Was it a setup? We can't know, but Ezra struck immediately. He summoned the leaders to take a public oath to act accordingly. Then, having gathered public support, he fell back on his coercive authority. He summoned all of those who had returned from the exile for a meeting in the temple, and threatened that he would confiscate the property of anyone who did not attend. The meeting took place 3 days later, on the 20th day of the ninth month, now about 4 months after Ezra had arrived. Ezra called on the assembled returnees to repent and dissolve the improper marriages. The returnees were sympathetic, but they were also tired and cold. "Many people are involved, and this is the rainy season," they said. "It is not possible to remain out in the open, nor is it the work of a day or two." They and Ezra agreed that they would return home, and Ezra would work with their officers to resolve the matter. The committee met on the first day of the 10th month, a little over a week later. 2 months later, the committee did what committees do best. They issued a report. The book of Ezra ends with this report, a list of the men who married foreign women. 114 men are on the list, a surprisingly small number, given both the number of those having returned in the first two waves, some 42,000 people, we're told, and the great deal that Ezra had made of it. We don't know what happened next, if anything. Did these men turn out their wives and children? One would think that the author, who was certainly sympathetic to Ezra, would have informed us if Ezra was successful. Perhaps the very absence of any notice that Ezra actually achieved his aim of breaking up these families is evidence that he didn't. These men could be shamed and their descendants immortalized as impure, but Ezra, who was brushing up against the limits of his power, could not actually punish them. Even more interesting, we don't know what happened to Ezra. He too disappears. Some scholars suggest that he, having gone too far, was recalled to Persia. Possibly, but it's pure speculation. Maybe he suddenly died. Maybe, properly chastened, he toned it down. Maybe he ended up marrying an attractive daughter of the peoples of the land. Who knows? This whole remarkable story took place within a single calendar year, and then Ezra was gone. Ezra might have been a genealogical zealot and a quasi-effectual leader, but he was most remembered as a dura Europus, as a scribe. Curiously, the book of Ezra, as it survives today, only mentions the fact that he was a scribe. It gives no indication what that might have meant. For an account of Ezra actually acting like a scribe, we have to turn to Nehemiah chapter 8, which, as I mentioned earlier, probably was originally part of the book of Ezra. This chapter provides a story that fills in Ezra's activities between the fifth month, when he arrived, and the ninth month, when the intermarriage crisis erupted. On the first day of the seventh month, according to Nehemiah 8, the entire people assembled to hear the reading of the scroll of the teaching of Moses. Ezra, identified here as both a scribe and a priest, climbed a wooden platform and, flanked by several leaders, read all morning. As he read, the Levites translated and explained what he was reading to the people. The people wept as they heard, but Ezra and his assistants shushed them. It was the first of Tishrei, and they were not to weep or mourn, but to rejoice, eat well, treat the day as holy. They had apparently not before thought that the first of Tishrei, Rosh Hashanah, was holy. The next day, the second of Tishrei, they made a similar discovery. This time, just the leaders gathered to study the scroll, and they discovered the festival of Sukkot, or tabernacles. They commanded people to bring the leafy branches of olive trees, pine trees, myrtles, palms, and other leafy trees to make booths, as it is written. The entire community of returnees, we are told, did so, and dwelt in the booths for 7 days, which, as we are told further, the Israelites had not done so from the days of Joshua, son of Nun, to that day. As I mentioned in the second episode of this podcast, here is a stunning example of interbiblical interpretation. Leviticus commands the Israelites to make booths and to rejoice with these different species of vegetation. What does rejoice mean? The author of this account clearly thinks that it means that the booths should be made from them. The rabbis later understand rejoice as meaning to wave a lulav and etrog, a ritual found nowhere in the Hebrew Bible. In any case, it is the scroll itself that is of more interest. What was in this scroll? Why did the people not seem to know about it, nor could even understand it? Many scholars see in this account the first relatively unambiguous evidence for the existence of the Torah. When Ezra quotes from or refers to what is written in the scroll, he refers not only to Deuteronomy, the only book apparently contained in the pre-exilic King Josiah's scroll. Ezra had something much closer to the Torah as we now know it. The people did not know about the Torah because it did not previously exist. To say, as Richard Elliot Friedman does in his wonderful book, Who Wrote the Bible, that it was Ezra himself who put the Torah together from previous sources, pushes the evidence too far. But it does not push it very far to say that the Torah emerged from and was promoted by the same proto-sectarian group in Babylonia to which belonged Ezra, Sheshbazzar, Zerubbabel, Joshua, and Nehemiah. It would be hard to overestimate the importance of the Torah. Artaxerxes thought it was a law code for the Jews. He would not have arrived at that determination himself. Clearly, it was the Torah's supporters who understood it that way and then convinced his court of it. At the same time, though, the Torah also enabled a new kind of authority, one that was grounded in the ability to read and interpret this text. 60 years earlier, the prophet Haggai still located religious authority in the unwritten traditions of the priests. Now the Jews learn about their holidays from a written text. I have now shifted my language. The appearance of the Torah dramatically alters the religion of Israel. By the mid-5th century, we may now begin to talk less of Israelites and more of Jews, those Judeans who understood themselves to be continuous with the history of Israel, who worshiped the God of Israel, and who now turn to the Torah for authority. The Torah is so important for the history of Jews and Judaism that it deserves its own separate discussion. And that is exactly what I will provide in the next episode. Find more information about the podcast at www.mlsadlow.com on the blog and public education pages. I welcome your comments. The original music is by Neil Ginsberg, with vocals by Michelle Tattenbaum. Thank you for listening.